Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here, The Tom Woods Show.
Hey everybody, welcome to The Tom Woods Show, episode 2391. Very glad to be joined by Rav Arora today, who is a writer. He's got a Substack that is very, very much worth reading, but he co-hosts a podcast with our good friend Jay Bhattacharya, the Stanford professor who was a member in good standing of the Stanford community for quite some time until he had a dissident opinion, and then good grief, what happened to him. But Rav, welcome to the show. I guess we're both fans of Jay Bhattacharya.
Hey, Tom. Yeah, great to be here. Yeah, I'm a big fan of Jay's, and he and I enjoy doing the Illusion of Consensus podcast on Substack, the Illusion of Consensus, where we have our articles and our podcast. It's a great time.
So before we get into your, you know, what you've been up to and some of the difficulties you've run into in just more or less trying to tell the truth, I like the title of the podcast, The Illusion of Consensus, because I think that's very descriptive of what we've just endured. We've been given the impression that all the respectable people think a certain way. And then you have obviously respectable people who think another way. And those people are just ignored or smeared or deplatformed or whatever. So what exactly goes on? I guess it's still kind of a young podcast. It's got, I think, just over a dozen episodes. What are you trying to do there?
Yeah, at the Illusion of Consensus, well, we're doing exactly what the title indicates, which is dismantle, expose, and break down various areas of consensus, particularly with COVID, which is where many people like myself had a bit of an awakening from prior trusting all the lockdown mask and even having faith in the vaccine measures, only to then investigate some of these issues and realize that, well, in my particular case, the vaccines were potentially likely net harmful and had many issues associated with them. So the Substack is devoted to dismantling some of that consensus, whether it's talking about vaccine adverse events, vaccine efficacy, related topics on masks and lockdowns and such, but also increasingly my own investigations journalistically into the overprescription of ADHD, antidepressant, and anti-anxiety medications, which is of particular interest to me as someone who's very, very interested in mental health, someone who's suffered from some of those issues and has a lot of trauma and a lot of mental illness in the family. Those issues are very, very interesting to me. And the more I've unraveled at the COVID fabric, the more I realize in other areas, there's a similar problem going on when it comes to mental health as well. When you have something like ADHD or depression, oftentimes the mainstream establishment perspective and prescription on those issues is just like what we saw with COVID, in that it's far too simplistic, manipulative, driven by the pharmaceutical industry, and sometimes even dangerous and not actually addressing the root cause, whether it's COVID. And we could talk about the obesity pandemic, which kind of underlied the COVID crisis, because here in America, in the US and the UK, we have a big obesity epidemic, but that was not talked about. Instead, it was everyone get the jabs, otherwise get out of your jobs. That was the big thing. So on our Illusion of Consensus Substack, which I hope people can subscribe to, that's what we're doing, is dismantling those various areas of popular but very pernicious consensus.
What's your background? And you answer that however you like, philosophically, where you come from in the country, educationally, whatever you want to tell us.
Yeah, so I'm in Vancouver, Canada, if you didn't know.
Oh, I didn't actually.
Yeah, so I'm not American, but I graduated from high school in 2019. And then right after that, my entry to journalism was when George Floyd happened. And I was always interested in racial topics and criminal justice. And so when I saw that and I saw the whole abolish the police, defund the police stuff, then I kind of came in and started writing about it and had a couple of viral essays in the New York Post, the Globe and Mail, Colette, a few other places that did really, really well. And that just suddenly I realized, like, oh, I can write and I can like do journalism. And so I started getting a lot of traction. And then that's how I got into this whole mess.
By the way, how did such a young guy get published in places like the New York Post?
I was thinking about this yesterday as I was listening to a couple of podcasts done by successful business people and kind of different insights that they had. Like, one of the insights that I think I've come across is that, I don't know what probability I want to put on it, but it can definitely be the case, as my life has shown, that a certain kind of boldness and ambition really interests certain people. And so that's how I've always been. I've always been very bold, very ambitious, and very much out there and fearless and unafraid and contrarian. So when I'm pitching a couple of editors at the start, the New York Post, the Globe and Mail, Quillette, a few of these other places, I'm saying, hey, I'm 20. I have this perspective. I feel like, you know, this narrative is wrong. Here's my perspective. And I have the data to support it. And I have some personal experience, you know, when it came to the New York Post and other places. I was writing a lot about identity politics in 2020 and how diversity mandates and further our conversation on police and criminal justice and other issues was being broken down along racial lines, right? And that I thought was a step backwards rather than forwards. And I used kind of my own experience with experiencing racism as a kid to help readers understand that this direction we're going in of white privilege and having, you know, the Black perspective and having the, you know, the Black perspective on certain topics and having the Indigenous perspective, et cetera, like that whole language was a step in the wrong direction and not actually getting us to where we want to get to in terms of achieving equality of opportunity and improving our society. So pitching various outlets from that perspective of originality, boldness, fearlessness, and ambition really struck a lot of people with kind of interest or inspiration. And so that's kind of how it started. So anyone listening, I encourage you to be bold in life and be fearless, because that's more and more proving to be somewhat successful in my case.
Well, of course, in a minute, I want to talk about what suddenly started happening when you would submit articles that, yeah, that touched on certain sensitive topics. So we'll get to that in a minute. But I know Canada was pretty tough in terms of lockdown, more or less everywhere. But were there some parts of the country that were worse than others?
Yeah, I mean, where I'm at in BC, it was particularly bad, the vaccine mandates that were imposed. I mean, we had lockdowns for a while and we had mask mandates, and the vaccine mandates here were pretty bad. I mean, couldn't exercise at a gym without having your vaccine card. Large gatherings, weddings, restaurants, certain extracurricular activities.
But more than that, you couldn't even escape. You couldn't get on a plane to leave if you disagreed with the policy.
So that was the federal mandate. So provincially, that's what was going on here in Vancouver. Yeah. Federally, yeah, I mean, it's crazy now looking back on it a bit, like that's where we were. It's like, yeah, I couldn't leave the country. My parents are from India. They chose to be unvaccinated and they couldn't go back home for a long time. My mom wanted to visit her relatives in India and she didn't want to get the COVID vaccine. So she was landlocked effectively, which is quite outrageous and completely unexpected when it comes to the Liberal government here in Canada, run by Trudeau, acting quite illiberally, honestly, in totalitarian ways.
It's interesting to me that in terms of allowing people into the country without getting the shots, that the United States was slower to drop that requirement than even Canada was. I wonder what's going on there. I'm surprised Canada lifted any of these things, actually.
I think we lifted them, the vaccine requirements, I think early this year, if I'm not mistaken, January, whereas you guys lifted them up until, so you guys had them in place up until like May.
Yeah.
Which is crazy. So like up until May, I couldn't come to your country because of Biden's policies, which was insane. And that's why you have the whole Novak Djokovic wanting to play tennis and he's deemed some flight risk that he can't enter your country and play tennis. I mean, none of this made sense. And this is why you have so much conspiracy thinking as well. Some of it that's vindicated, other that's genuinely conspiracy and crazy, is that when you have leaders completely embarrassing themselves, failing, manipulating the public, treating people like little toddlers, I mean, openly lying and misleading about topics, that's what's fueled a lot of the so-called misinformation, some of which, or a lot of which, has even been vindicated when it comes to vaccine risks, you know, mask mandates, etc.
By the way, just in parentheses, Jay Bhattacharya is a professor at Stanford. He has an MD and a PhD, and he lives in the U.S. So how did the two of you meet?
Yeah, so we just met for the first time in San Francisco in person, actually, but it was a great dinner hosted by Substack founders. But he and I got in touch September of 2021, and this kind of relates to my story, which I've told a couple of times before, about how vaccine mandates were imposed in Canada, August of 2021. And then I, for the first time, actually started taking interest in this because suddenly me going to the gym, me doing my regular activities was dependent on me taking this vaccine. So I previously didn't really have a position on lockdowns and masks. I didn't really care. I mean, I knew I was safe. I knew my parents were safe at the time. But then I started looking into the COVID vaccine and I saw the risk of heart inflammation, myocarditis that was being reported. And I was deeply alarmed and concerned and thought that these mandates were unethical, unscientific, and draconian, and fundamentally stripping us from our civil liberties and personal autonomy. And so trying to make sense of all this, I saw Jay Bhattacharya on Twitter. He seemed to be making a lot of sense. So I just messaged him and said, hey, could we chat? I want to make sense of some of this. And he validated and confirmed a lot of my concerns, which the mainstream public health authorities in Canada and mainstream media were not confirming or validating, but actually deeming concerns such as the ones that I had, conspiracy theory and misinformation and right-wing propaganda and, you know, whatever. So Jay and I developed this collaboration where we were talking continuously over Zoom, WhatsApp, and then I was quoting him in a few articles. And so that turned into the basis for this collaboration, which is now the Illusion of Consensus Substack.
It's interesting to hear you say that during much of the lockdown period, you were more or less indifferent to the policy. I live in Florida, and it really is true what they say about Florida. After the initial however many months, life really did more or less go back to normal, other than there were way more masks in Florida than I think people think. I live in Central Florida and masks were everywhere. The panhandle was pretty unmasked for most of the time, but there were masks everywhere. But other than that, and I know that's a big other than that, but still, you were able to do more or less what you wanted. And there was live music, there was theater, all this stuff was going on with no problem. And yet, even though I got to have that and a lot of other people didn't, I still felt quite a bit of sadness and frustration, even despair, and thinking that, wondering if normal life would ever be resumed and travel and normal communication and human interaction would ever be resumed. Was it that you weren't worried about that, or was it that you felt like the danger was so great that it was frivolous even to worry about these things?
I was worried about a lot of things, but particularly in 2020, when George Floyd happened, that was at the center of my attention. And that's how I kind of rose as a journalist, was first writing about George Floyd and the riots and protests and calls to defund the police, and then just the acceleration of identity politics and implementing racial quotas. I mean, that's what I was doing in 2020, was writing a lot about the culture war and a lot about criminal justice. And, you know, you saw all the politics and hypocrisy around that, right? I mean, epidemiologists first saying that anti-lockdown protests are going to kill grandma. They're incredibly dangerous and harmful. But then when George Floyd happens, dozens or maybe even hundreds, I can't remember how many epidemiologists signed on this letter, but it was a very large number of well-known epidemiologists signed on to a letter saying that not only are these protests against white supremacy and police injustice warranted, but are actually necessary, and racism or white supremacy is a greater threat to public health than COVID is. So, you know, at that time, it's crazy to think how experts embarrass themselves at that time. But that's what I was focused on at that particular moment, because, I mean, for that amount of time, the conversation on COVID was kind of frozen. And you had people like Peter Hotez and others that were suddenly focused on protests being warranted. And that was at the front page of the New York Times and CNN. So those were my concerns for quite some time before vaccine mandates were imposed. And then suddenly my livelihood was significantly impacted, right? Because then I can't go to a gym and, again, large gatherings, weddings, landlocked, can't go to India, can't come to your country, etc.
Well, let's talk about now. Here you are, this young, up-and-coming writer, having considerable success, publishing in fairly prominent outlets. And then something happens, because you think to yourself, yeah, I'm this young, contrarian voice, you know, with an energetic writing style and an interesting dissident point of view. Surely they'll welcome my dissident views on these other topics. I read your article on the subject, and it turns out that was not actually the case.
Yeah, I was quite shocked at the response I got, because I'd been immunized from cancel culture and backlash for taking controversial positions, which I never thought were controversial. I just thought I was speaking the truth and writing with the facts. But, you know, I was taking the controversial positions on reporting on the rise in homicides in Minneapolis and how residents in inner city communities were actually against abolishing the police, yet the mainstream media took a different slant to that problem. And I'd established myself as a writer taking some of those positions and building relationships with editors that were, in some cases, less open to that, but became open to that. In other cases, open to that from the start. So I'd built up this reputation and was on this path of trying to find the truth, no matter where it would lead me. But then when vaccine mandates were imposed, I started investigating it, writing about it, looking into side effects, efficacy, talking to Dr. J and other individuals like Dr. Vinay Prashad. Then I was pitching stories to a number of editors, and I've deliberately not mentioned them or mentioned the outlets to avoid any crazy conflicts or any kind of hostility. I genuinely was disappointed and frustrated and, you know, wasn't making basically any money for a while because the message was clear. We're not going to publish this, right?
Well, let's get specific. What exactly were they not going to publish and why? Because they told you.
Yeah. They said, we're a pro-vaccine publication. We're promoting the vaccine. We're not going to publish this. This may drive anti-vax hysteria. This may be dangerous to the public. This may discourage people from getting vaccinated, et cetera. Like, that was the narrative. And the stories I was pitching, to be precise, was on vaccine side effects, particularly myocarditis, or just generally the ethics of mandating an experimental vaccine in some cases. And in other cases, trying to write about some of the controversy surrounding Joe Rogan, Novak Djokovic, Kyrie Irving. When you're a freelance journalist, you try to come up with different ways to get your writing out there. And oftentimes, you need to pick something in the news, something that's getting a lot of attention, and using that to expose a deeper topic and go into some depth on a very important subject. And I was doing all those creative things, but I was hitting a wall repeatedly, including places that I thought would allow dissent on this topic. But here I was, vaccine side effects, no mandates, no. And so that's what led to the migration on the illusion of consensus. It was honestly not necessarily like I wanted to do it right away. Now I'm loving it and I enjoy the community there and writing freely on the illusion of consensus Substack. But me being pushed towards independent journalism on Substack was a product of being continually rejected and what I felt kind of my creativity and my pursuit of the truth suppressed on these topics.
Would you say that a lot of these outlets have maybe liberalized their opinions by now, given that I think the shots might not have quite lived up to the promises that were made about them? And maybe there's something, because a lot of people are talking now about the myocarditis problem, about quote unquote rare breakthrough infections, about whatever. There's plenty of stuff on this now. Are they allowing it now?
Well, from my own experience, I'm not really going back and trying to do those articles for those publications. It's honestly, for a while, like, still to an extent, it's kind of like, f*** you. Like, you didn't want that. You want to adhere to this kind of religious narrative. And, you know, you can keep doing that. I'm on my own now at this point. With respect to what I sense from the media right now at this point, I mean, I'm not exactly sure if there's been any dramatic changes. I mean, I remember last year during the bivalent booster campaign in the Biden administration, the bivalent booster shot, which was the updated vaccine, which was targeted to the original strain, but also the newer one at that time. And it was tested in like 12 mice, and the FDA viewed that as adequate testing
Actually, I think you're giving them too much credit. It was only 8 mice.
It was 8.
Yeah, 12 mice. Yeah. Well, maybe I'll think about it, but 8, you know. Well, and by the way, that whole argument about you would be fueling vaccine hesitancy by publishing an article like this has been used to justify suppressing stories that the government and the media admit are true, but that if these stories of vaccine injuries get out, that could fuel vaccine hesitancy. So we really want to try to steer people away from stories like that, even though they'll just openly admit, yeah, that's a true story. I mean, that's deranged. Let people make up their own minds on the basis of the evidence they can gather.
Yeah, there's a strange kind of really like tyrannical kind of mindset or assumption that you have to treat the public as like little children. You have to talk down to them. we can't have a nuanced conversation. We can't talk about the complex risk-benefit analyses on mRNA vaccines, masks, or ivermectin, or whatever. We have to call ivermectin horse paste, right? It's horse dewormer, because we can't have an honest conversation about risk-benefit. I mean, we can't even say, like, well, maybe we need more evidence on this or more studies. You know, it might be effective. We just have to call it horse dewormer, right? And
yeah,
you had like the FDA tweeting out something completely stupid and asinine about this is for horses, not for people or something, right? I mean, most people don't really understand the complete capture of places like the FDA. I mean, in late 2021, I wish more people knew about this, but this was in the Washington Post, which platformed a co-written op-ed by two leading FDA officials that resigned from the vaccine approval committee because of the organization's zealous push for the booster shot in young, healthy people. They didn't feel like it was the right decision, right? So they left the FDA, right? That's what's become of the FDA. And then they approved the bivalent shot last fall, not only, by the way, adults or elderly people, but for kids down to 6 months old. The FDA was saying, if you're a seven-month-old baby, right, you know, if you're the parents of a seven-month-old baby, they should get vaccinated, right? And then you had all the complete propaganda, in my opinion, right, during Christmas time, and all the Christmas campaigns of, well, you're going to be with your family during Christmas time, get your fourth or fifth or sixth bivalent booster shot. And now here we are, by the way, we're in that same cycle with Moderna and Pfizer. There's press releases yesterday about how preliminary preclinical studies in mice show that their new updated booster shot has shown, surprise, surprise, an increased antibody response or increased antibody titers, which means basically nothing when it comes to real world implications and efficacy in the real world. I mean, you have to do trials on human beings and see if you're getting, you know, the same rate of adverse events or a different rate or what the efficacy exactly is. But I won't be surprised if the FDA approves the new updated booster shot and the Biden administration will push these on Americans, which I think is completely dangerous and reckless.
Hey, folks, let's take a minute to thank our sponsor, Crowd Health. We all know how bad the American healthcare system is and how ridiculous the quote-unquote health insurance that we all have is. We've got increasing premiums, deductibles are getting larger, claims denials happening more frequently. The whole process is extremely opaque, the opposite of transparent. And this headache is exactly why Crowd Health was created. It's not health insurance. It's a better way to pay for healthcare through crowdfunding. You can break free from the antiquated insurance system without breaking the bank and get into a healthcare option that fits your needs. Let me tell you a little something about Anthony from New Jersey, who wrote to tell me this. I heard about Crowd Health on your show a while back and signed up with your link. My wife and I are in our early 30s and are expecting our first child in October. That's really soon. To date, they have been great to work with, and I wanted to pass along a good review for them. I was curious to see how this would all work out during pregnancy, but they have been great. Highly recommended. Well, the way it all works is Crowd Health gives you the kind of peace of mind that traditional insurance does not. So your $50 a month gets you the resources you need to get the kind of care you want. So that means telemedicine visits, discounted prescriptions, so much more. No doctor's network screwing things up. You'll have access to your own personal care advocate who will help you navigate the complexities of health events and even negotiate bills on your behalf. So it's time you opt out of restrictive health insurance plans and let Crowd Health fit your healthcare needs. Get started today for just $50 per month. Go to joincrowdhealth.com/woods to get the healthcare you deserve. Crowd Health is not insurance. Learn more at joincrowdhealth.com/woods. That's joincrowdhealth.com/woods. You may recall that at one point, the official sources were telling us that COVID was a top five killer of children. Now, anybody even remotely following this matter knew that was false. There's no way you'd be tricked by that. And yet all the official sources were saying that. And it was a lay woman with no statistical or medical background, who just looked at the data, this Kelly Cronert from Georgia, I had her on the show,
yeah, she's
and
great.
Said, they're all full of it, and they had to retract it. And so I had a whole thread on this on Twitter, which, I'm sorry, I'm going to be the last person on earth still calling it Twitter. I can't, just can't change. But yeah. Jerome Adams, the former Surgeon General, jumps into my thread and start saying, well, you know, the experts can't get everything right, but in general, we need to defer to them. And this, and I said, but hold on a minute. I said, this isn't like, I'm asking you to distinguish between two extremely similar things and only an expert could distinguish them.
Yeah.
This is a matter where anybody remotely knowledgeable knew that was a fake statistic. That was what I said.
Yeah.
We all knew that, and it took this lay person to point it out, and then you wonder why nobody trusts public health. Who would?
Yeah, well, first of all, Jerome Adams is a complete joke. I don't trust the guy. I saw one of his tweets like today saying that, well, you know, the updated booster shot looks good, and America should be getting it, and here are the reasons why. And it's like, what reasons do you have? But when it comes to like the errors from the CDC, I mean, it's not just that one thing, right? It's not just that. There was a whole paper written by Dr. Vinay Prasad and Dr. Tracy Beth Hogue.
Oh, listing all the things they got wrong. Yeah.
Wasn't just one thing, man.
Yeah.
Look at the peer-reviewed paper. It's like dozens of errors.
Yeah.
Over and over and over again. It's like, you guys need to like fire your employees and like invite like a few Substack bloggers like myself who like don't have any scientific background to do your freaking statistical analysis.
Right.
This doesn't even pass like grade 12 statistics, honestly. It's a joke.
Well, I brought up the children one in particular because of, you were talking about childhood vaccination. So that reminded me of that particular episode because that statistic was being thrown out there alongside the propaganda about vaccinating young people. That, well, you see, look, it's a major, major threat to your kid. And so you better go out and do it. I mean, it was an unbelievable attempt at manipulation. And thankfully, we had sensible people who realized what was going on. But I mean, these are, I don't know how you put a benign spin on that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the risk towards kids. I mean, I've had exchanges with Peter Hotez publicly where I've gone back and forth with him. I'm actually on a friendly basis with him, by the way. And I've tried to arrange a podcast and hopefully we can make it happen. But he and I have gone back and forth publicly where I've asked him like, hey, honest question, Peter, you know, should someone like me get the bivalent booster? Should healthy people in their 20s consider getting the fourth shot? Because I'm not seeing the data. And, you know, he comes back to me multiple times and says, due to the serious grave risk of long COVID and hospitalizations, I urge young people, I'm paraphrasing, I urge young people to get the bivalent booster shot. And it's like, it's just embarrassing. And it's just like, one can't help but think about certain conspiracy theories or certain uncharitable interpretations, let's say, of these guys. Is Peter Hotez, who's a vaccine expert, who has many more degrees than I do, many more years of education and expertise in this area, can he not read data the way this 22-year-old, kid like I can? Like, why can't he understand that from the start when it comes to younger people, but also older people as well, that this was a problem primarily of obese, immunocompromised, and elderly people and people with multiple comorbidities? Everyone other than that was not facing this colossal existential risk that was being promoted in the media.
What did you have the exchange with Mark Cuban about?
Yeah. So Mark is just such an interesting, case study of just being captured by the mainstream dominant narrative on COVID, this kind of rich billionaire Democrat elite class of people that read the New York Times, watch CNN, MSNBC, Rachel Maddow. These people are your arbiters of truth, right? And so you have someone like him who, the backstory is that, I'm not sure I can even fully reveal some of the behind the scenes stuff, but there was a behind the scenes exchange, which Joe Rogan had a hand in playing about a year ago between me and Mark. And it was about the vaccine myocarditis issue. And he and I had this big exchange. And he was not at all admitting to any of the data on vaccine myocarditis. And then Joe, for whatever reason, he was asked by Patrick Bet-David on his podcast in early August about Mark Cuban. Now Mark has criticized Joe. And then Joe brought up, well, I've seen Mark's exchanges with Rav over email about the stuff, and he doesn't know what he's talking about. Then I post it, and then Mark sees it, and then Mark gets quite triggered that Joe was talking about him in this negative way. And so he went after me and Joe, and he and I had this extended back and forth about this particular topic about vaccine myocarditis and mandates. And it's, people can go read it. It's on my Substack. I've kind of organized it so people can read step by step how it happened. But essentially, it's a story of Mark just visibly and publicly displaying complete cognitive dissonance, complete kind of mental like breakdown, like not understanding the reality of the situation, like I guess if I were to offer an analogy, like, you know, if suddenly we learn tomorrow that eating vegetables is incredibly bad for you. And actually, there's some people that argue that, by the way, Dr. Paul Salad, you know, the carnivore diet, et cetera. But let's say that there's an overwhelming consensus tomorrow, eating vegetables is incredibly bad for you. Stop eating your fruits, stop eating your kale and your carrots and whatever you eat, stop. It's really dangerous for you, right? That's kind of where Mark was operating from, is that all his priors were, you know, New York Times, CNN, FDA, CDC, and I'm presenting to him a perspective on that level, right? Because for him, New York Times and CNN is gospel, right? Just in the way we have certain priors that, you know, are defensible and you know, are true. And for him, when it came to vaccines, those were his kind of biblical beliefs that safe and effective for everyone. Vaccine side effects are completely rare. They're not a big deal. They're mild, goes away quickly, all this kind of misinformation. And so he and I are just going back and forth, and he's just hasn't recognized the level of capture and corruption in some of these agencies like the FDA and the CDC.
The way I think about it is, look, obviously, if I need to get my car repaired, I want a quote unquote expert on car repair to do it. I don't want somebody who's practicing astrology to try to figure out how to fix my car. I want the expert to do it. So on some level, I acknowledge expertise and the value of it. But there obviously are some fields that are just beyond screwed up for whatever reason, that are just screwed up. And it would seem to me that after one failed prediction after another coming from so-called public health, I guess my question would be, what more do these people need to do for you to say, maybe I've misplaced my confidence in them? Yeah. What exactly would need to happen for you to say that? And I mean, all the times it was predicted that Florida was going to be in the toilet and there are going to be corpses all over the street. And in age-adjusted COVID mortality, where number one is the worst, and 50, you know, all 50 states plus the District of Columbia, 51, Florida's all the way down at 36. Now, not one of these people would have predicted that. Not one. They all would have said top five, for sure it'll be top five, if not number one. 36. That doesn't make him think, maybe this was overblown. Maybe we didn't understand it that well. Maybe the experts are pulling their science out of their you-know-where. I mean, really, what would it take? This is a rhetorical question. I don't know what it would take for him, but apparently it would take a lot.
That's a good kind of hypothetical question. I mean, what would it take? I mean, I've talked to some people who you may know who would disagree with us, some very well-known people, and they're still explicitly operating from if we find out definitively, I guess, that the Pfizer Moderna vaccines were more harmful than we thought. There's already good data on this, in my opinion. There's a study by Freeman and colleagues in the journal Vaccine, which found a 1 in 800 serious adverse event rate associated with the mRNA vaccines, far higher than any other vaccine we've seen. And other vaccines, like the 1976 swine flu vaccine, was pulled off the market for adverse event rates of 1 in 100,000. But here with COVID, we're seeing ballparks of 1 in 800 with the mRNA shots, right? So I already think there's good data on that. But I've had the author of that study on my podcast talk about this stuff, and their study's not promoted, right? They can't go in the New York Times and talk about their study. They're not on CNN or even Wall Street Journal to talk about their study. They can't get any press release for it. It's basically me and maybe one other person or a couple other people that are talking about their study, and, you know, no one else is. So there is that problem. But I guess if more and more data comes out, which I think definitely will, then I think these people will be forced to confront with the harsh reality. And I think there are a couple of things that we're waiting for. We're waiting for Pfizer and Moderna's subclinical myocarditis studies, which there's been a couple of small studies looking at subclinical myocarditis. So elevated troponin levels in young adolescent boys and girls, which isn't classified as clinical myocarditis. So they're not necessarily experiencing symptoms, but there has been some heart damage or some elevated cardiac biomarkers. And there's one study from Thailand, because apparently we can't run these studies. So Thailand runs these studies, and I've written about this before, and they showed a 2-3% rate of some clinical myocarditis. Small study, like a couple hundred kids, 2-3% of them had elevated cardiac biomarkers. And if that's extrapolated to the broader population, then what we're looking at, and that this really concerns me, is massive numbers of young people and older people that had adverse side effects that they don't even know about and that may have long-term implications.
Right. So, and you would assume, and I say this as not a medical person, but just somebody with common sense, that with each new booster you get, you're intensifying the problem. And again, you, as you say, with long-term implications, what does this mean when these people all turn 50? What does it mean? It seems like a legitimate conversation to have, and yet you can't have it for some reason, or you can, there are only certain corners that are allowed to have it or something. I don't know. My view on all this has always just been, there's no reason not to allow adults to have conversations. Some people will have conversations that are all wrong, but the problem is if you give a monopoly to one institution over what is acceptable, what is misinformation, what is disinformation, and what is legitimate mainstream medicine, I don't know that there's any one institution that can be trusted with that power. And it certainly is not the U.S. government, which has a horrific record. I mean, these are people, when you look at the Michelle Obama school lunches, she thinks nutrition studies ended in 1977, for heaven's sake.
Yeah.
These are people who told us it was bad to eat eggs. It's going to hurt you to eat eggs. You don't want to do that. You want to eat whatever, 11 servings of grain a day. You know, I think it's much, much better to have a robust discussion with numerous people.
Yeah.
Hey, everybody, a quick message from our friends at Policy Genius who sponsored this episode. If you have a family like I do, you know how much your loved ones depend on you. And if anything should happen, you do not want them worrying about money. Now, you may have coverage at work, but that's almost certainly going to be insufficient. And it doesn't follow you if you change jobs. Now, one reason a lot of people don't get life insurance is they think they can't afford it. That's why I didn't at first. I thought, well, how could I possibly get, quote, $1 million worth of insurance? That sounds crazy. But then you actually price it out and you realize, wait a minute, I can afford it after all. And it gives you enormous peace of mind. Well, it's even easier to do it now because you have the help of Policy Genius. With just a few mouse clicks, you can be comparing quotes from top insurers and getting the best package for you. As a matter of fact, with Policy Genius, you can find life insurance policies that start at just $292 a year for $1 million of coverage. Some options offer same-day approval and avoid unnecessary medical exams. They work for you, not the insurance company, so they don't have an incentive to recommend one insurer over another. You can trust their guidance. They have thousands of five-star reviews on Trustpilot and Google, so check them out. Your loved ones deserve a financial safety net. You deserve a smarter way to find and buy it. Head to policygenius.com or click the link in the description or on the show notes page to get your free life insurance quotes and see how much you could save. That's policygenius.com.
So what I was talking about, what we're talking about long-term safety of mRNA vaccines, there was a disclaimer that Pfizer got South Africa to sign. It's been on Twitter the last couple of days.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you've seen this, but I'm reading exactly from the disclaimer, which says that purchaser further acknowledges that the long-term effects and efficacy of the vaccine are not currently known, and that there may be adverse effects of the vaccine that are not currently known. Further, to the extent applicable, purchaser acknowledges that the product shall not be serialized. So that's directly coming from Pfizer. This is not conspiracy theory, right? They themselves cannot possibly know some of the long-term adverse effects. And I'm waiting for that subclinical study, which, by the way, was supposed to be submitted in December of 2022. And then they got an extension to, I believe, June of 2023. And we still haven't gotten the results of the subclinical myocarditis study. And I predict that it's going to be a big bombshell, but I don't know what they're doing right now. And we know pharmaceutical companies manipulate the results. We know what they say in their studies, so many studies on vaccines. Well, there's a risk of myocarditis, but the vaccines are generally considered safe and well-received, blah, 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 blah. Like, there's all these ways where pharmaceutical companies are able to manipulate the data and kind of interpret it or spin it in a certain way so it doesn't look as damning as it might. So we'll see what happens there.
Yeah, it's one of these subject areas where people seem to speak in rehearsed phrases and sentences. You know, like when somebody just repeats a slogan to me over and over again, like safe and effective or vaccines work. I mean, I have honestly seen intelligent conversations going on Twitter and somebody comes along and says vaccines work, like two words are going to change people's minds. When people talk like that, That's actually what makes me suspicious. You know, because I went into this not thinking one way or another about vaccines at all, not thinking about the COVID one or anything. Didn't even cross my mind. Yeah. But when I look at people speaking with religious fervor about something and refusing to allow dissident voices, well, now that's when you're going to get more dissident voices. So if you don't want them, don't act like a cult, you know, then maybe you won't get as many.
Yeah. You know, I think a lot of us are allergic to that kind of religious fervor. Well, whether it's, you know, actually religious fervor, which, you know, when you talk to people of certain faiths and they're completely dogmatically attached to one way of looking at things, you know, and I'm someone who deeply respects various religious traditions and attends church, does meditation, you know, studies different faiths, by the way, on the side of university. I'm studying comparative religions. That's kind of my other thing. Well, most people don't know that about me, but that's one of my other interests.
Now they do.
Now they do. But yeah, when you see the vaccine treated as this kind of sacramental product, like you take this and this is going to uplift you and put you in the good, virtuous group. And if you don't take it, then you're part of the sinful, dirty group. You're part of the out group. And if you want to be part of the in group, you get the sacrament. That's right when so many people turn completely skeptical and allergic to that kind of thinking, when it's like, you have to do this thing, otherwise you're a bad person, right? When things get overly moralistic rather than actually data-oriented and, you know, grounded with the facts, then you sow more and more distrust and you end up losing what should be credibility in the FDA and the CDC. And so when you have people like Sam Harris saying, like, we need to trust the FDA and the CDC, it's like, well, yes, we need to trust for the FDA and CDC, but it's not conspiratorial thinking on the public. I mean, yes, that's always existed on the fringes. You're never going to convince everybody, right? There's people that think right now the earth is flat, right? There's people that actually think that. There's people that believe in QAnon. There's people that think all sorts of crazy things. People like, you know, like my mom believes in astrology. Like, there's all sorts of ideas that people believe, right? And you're never going to get to everyone. But this whole like vaccine hesitancy thing, like, this is largely a product of the pandemic, not what's been going on before, right? When you look at countries like Canada and the US, vaccine hesitancy is not really a problem, right? Vaccines are very, very popular. You know, when I go back to high school, like, you know, which is not that long for me, right? Just going back 3 or 4 years, like, the school tells us, like, the nurses are here, get your flu shots. And I remember this, like, in grade 12, and I just called my mom, like, hey, they're asking us to get the flu shots. And my mom's like, yeah, you can go get it. I'm like, all right, great, go get the flu shot. Like, that's always been the way people like myself look at these things. And, you know, people like Joe Rogan, many of the people in popular media and alternative media, Jordan Peterson's talked about this. It's like, you've always been a believer in vaccines, but this COVID pandemic has turned, you know, us people into rational skeptics, right? We're not diehard anti-vaxxers. We're just people that are rational and genuine and want to learn what's actually good for our health. And so when we don't see the facts align with what the narrative is, then suddenly you have a problem of vaccine hesitancy that's not generated by conspiratorial thinking in general, but rather by the CDC, the FDA, and mainstream experts completely failing to promote the facts over the narrative.
So the illusion of consensus, people can access that. I'm going to have it linked in the description and also on the show notes page, which is, this is episode 2391. So tomwoods.com/2391. But can you just say it out? What would people type in to get to it?
Yeah, it's illusionconsensus.com. I'm just going to double. Yeah, illusionconsensus.com. People can check it out. And we can, we sometimes do this. We can put it in the description, because it's, you know, now that I've gone independent, it's very important for people to support us. We can forward you a link for a 10% off discount for anyone who wants to be a paid subscriber, which when you get into independent journalism, that becomes more and more important. So anyone who would like to support us, that'd be great. Although we still keep a lot of content free and we want to keep promoting as much work as we can without putting many things behind the paywall. But Dr. J and I do some exclusive Q&As and monthly Zoom calls with our paid subscribers and give them more exclusive content and video podcasts, et cetera. So that's the plug.
Okay. Well, we'll encourage that. As I say, check the description beneath the video, or if you're listening, tomwoods.com/2391, or just illusionconsensus.com. All those places are where you can get to it. Well, great to get to know you, Rev. I appreciate hearing your story and that you're intrepid and young and energetic and going to be doing a lot of good things for us for quite some time to come. Thanks so much. And say hello to Jay.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Thanks for having me on, Tom. And I enjoyed hearing more about your work on the recent Dave Smith, Joe Rogan podcast.
That was a nice surprise, wasn't it?
Yeah. That was great. Yeah, I saw that. I'm like, oh, Tom's on though. It's great. So I've been delving more and more into your work. So that's how you and I kind of came into contact recently, is when I reached out to you. So I appreciate the work you're doing and fighting the good fight, being pro-freedom, and actually being a real libertarian, in my view, as opposed to certain other libertarian thinkers and organizations that I felt got captured during COVID.
Yeah, I know. I mean, we can do an episode on that too. All right. Thanks a million. I appreciate it.
Great. Thanks.
And thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.